Very thankful to be a speaker this evening, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk on this particular theme. On the schedule, it said that I was going to talk about Russian history, and that's not exactly what I plan on talking about this evening. Specifically, what I'd like to talk about is preaching the gospel in Russia and how our preaching of the gospel should be tailored by the culture and history of the people. The main idea that I'd like to present this evening is it's important to know something about the people you're preaching to help you understand what topics to preach on and how to approach them with the gospel. We have plenty of precedents of this in the New Testament, of course. Jesus presented the glad tidings of the gospel of the kingdom in various ways to various people in different ways. When he spoke to the woman at the well, he met her on her terms with her question about worship. When he talked to the Pharisees, he met them on their terms with their difficulties and hypocrisy. The Apostle Paul, too, understood something about the people he preached to, and the way in which he delivered the gospel to those people depended on their culture and history, on their religious viewpoint. When he preached in Athens in Acts chapter 17, he declared a wonderful message about the existence of God and the character and nature of God. An incredible sermon, because those people in Athens worshipped idols, and they were confused by their human wisdom and philosophies. In Acts chapter 13, when he preached in Antioch to the Jews, he presented the gospel in a different way. The same gospel message, the same gospel of Jesus Christ, who came to die for us and save us from our sins. But he preached to them about how Jesus fulfilled the prophets, and how if they wish to be consistent with history, they ought to obey Jesus Christ, whom God had raised from the dead. If Paul had talked about idolatry and about the existence of God in Antioch to the Jews, that is, if he had given the same sermon he preached in Athens to the Jews in Antioch, I'm sure they would have understood his message to some degree, and they would have nodded their heads in agreement with what he was saying, but his message would not have moved them like it moved them and could have moved them by reflecting on their history, things that they understood. And so that's why it's important to know something about the people that we speak to, and then preach to them the gospel of Jesus Christ in view of what we know about them. I'm not a scholar on Russian history, nor am I a scholar on the Russian work itself, but I'd just like to present to you some ideas this evening that might spur your thinking, and as there are several in the crowd this evening who have preached in Russia and others who have preached in other cultures, I'm sure you could add something to what we'd like to say this evening. But knowing the culture and history of a people is important to understanding how to preach the gospel to them. Because culture and history forms what we call a worldview that people have. Their view of the world, their relationship to their world, their relationship to God, their relationship to other human beings is determined by their culture, their history, the social environment in which they live. And so that's why it behooves us to understand something about Russian culture and history before we go over there and preach the gospel, so that we know exactly what we should be preaching about and how to present the gospel of Jesus Christ. In one audience, in one particular public audience, you might find people of many different worldviews. That's rather different than the audiences you would find here in the United States. I think it would be safe to say that most audiences that we preach to here in the United States are of a consistent worldview. People pretty much have the same understanding of themselves and their society. We find a lot of uniformity in the audiences that we preach to many times, because sometimes our audience is a very narrow sort of audience. But on the other hand, in Russia, the audience can be very varied. You can have people in the audience who are atheists, agnostics, people who know nothing whatsoever about religion, have no particular viewpoint, others who are entrenched in the Russian Orthodox religion, and this presents different worldviews. You can have people who are from the town, people who are from the country, peasant people, and this will influence their view of what you're saying and your ability to communicate the gospel of Jesus Christ. Sometimes we use terms and vocabulary that we think people ought to be able to understand. But unfortunately, the vocabulary that we use may not be understood in exactly the same sense as our audience may understand that vocabulary. one common term, of course, that we use here in the United States, a term of denomination, Baptist, means one thing to us here in the United States. It means a particular group of people, a particular denomination with a particular viewpoint about salvation and the destiny of man. On the other hand, in Russia, the term Baptist has a broad reference. Baptist to them refers to just about anyone who's not Orthodox. And that's because of some characteristics of the religious history in Russia. So I'd like to do this evening is present some ideas about different focal points in our preaching the gospel in Russia. And in so doing, we'll make certain references to Russian history and culture and see how that affects the gospel message. First of all, though, one very important obstacle to overcome in preaching the gospel is to describe the difference between culture and religion. Because to most people in Russia, religion is just a matter of culture. And it's a very difficult thing to try to sort out culture from religion for them. Because to them, religion is part of their culture. But religion should not be part of culture. And to them, it would be difficult to change their religion because to change their religion means to change something about their culture. So let's think for a moment about culture and religion. And think about this first point about confusion between culture and religion. Culture really has to do with such things as language, literature, art, that defines the identity of a certain people, of certain nationality. And people rely on such things as art and literature and their language and their customs to identify who they are as a people. But religion ought not to form part of culture, because culture, rather religion, defines who we are in view of the truth, in the view of reality. Religion involves questions about truth, where culture does not. Questions about whether a particular piece of art is true or false are not valid questions. You don't ask whether a piece of art is true or false because art is representation, it's not science. You don't ask questions about true or false about a person's language. Language is expression. But you can ask questions about truth and falsity concerning religion. So religion cannot be an expression of culture. But throughout the history of Russia, religion has been part of culture. Religion has been the pivotal point of culture. To be a Russian has many times in history meant to be Orthodox. If you are not Orthodox, you are somehow not Russian. And if you are a member of another religious group, that there are other religious groups present in Russia, then somehow you are not as Russian as other people. If you are Islamic, if you are Jewish and you live in Russia, then you're not as Russian as Russians are, because Russians are Orthodox. At various times in the history of Russia too, religion has been more important than at other times. At certain times, religion has been used by the communist government for their own purposes, and at other times, the communist government has opposed religion. During this particular time in Russia, whereas in the past the communists persecuted the Orthodox Church, at this time in Russian society, the Russian Church, the Orthodox Church, is turning towards communism for help. And so the Russian Orthodox Church is more apt to be communistic in its leaning than not. Because at the present time, the Russian Orthodox Church would like to keep foreigners out and foreign preachers out. And they're looking to the communist government for help in doing that. And so you see, culture has pivoted on religion at various points in our history. So religion proposes to teach man about the truth of God, about the truth of his own being, the truth about his relationship to God, and the truth about his behavior and how he ought to behave as a human being and as a child of God. And religion cannot be true or false based on culture. That is, religion should not change based on your culture. If you step out of your culture, what is true and what is false cannot suddenly change. What is true and false about God does not suddenly change when you step out of your culture. So the truth that we preach in Russia cannot change depending on culture. And that's one point we have to make clear with people, that we are not teaching a cultural form of Christianity. Here's the point. We've not come to Russia to teach an American form of Christianity, a Christianity that reflects American culture. We've come to Russia to teach Christianity as Jesus taught it. And that Christianity should not be dependent on culture. When religion is influenced by culture, of course, many changes take place. Religion can be filled with traditions that are traditions founded upon certain aspects of culture. Christianity here in the United States has changed because of our culture. You know that many people here in the United States, many preachers on the television preach what we call a prosperity gospel. Preaching that if you're a child of God, all you need to do is ask God for whatever you want, and you can demand it of Him because you're His child, and He'll bless you with it, whatever it might be, a fancy car or lots of money. But you see, those same preachers would not be successful preaching that message in another culture, such as a third world country. So Christianity here in the United States has changed because of cultural influence. We want to make sure, too, that when we go to Russia, that we're not presenting a sort of American form of religion, that we are presenting Christianity as it is revealed through the teachings of Jesus Christ. Another aspect of that comes to surface in a study of Russian history and Russian culture is a view of authority. This is very important, I think, because, of course, Russians for so long and so many years have... I can't write and talk at the same time. Russians for so long have labored under a totalitarian view of authority. What is totalitarianism? Totalitarianism is a form of government in which the state has absolute control over the individual and influences that control, dominates society by the use of terror, by the use of persecution. And that's a kind of the society that Russians have lived in for centuries, not only under communism, but under the Tsars, too, before communism. Because the Tsars had absolute control over society. During the time of the Tsars, before communism came into power, Russian society was made up of lords and serfs. Serfs were pretty much on the same level as a slave. The serfs were tied to the land. And they could not move, they could not go anyplace. They were tied to the land and to their lord. The lord did not own them as much as the land did, but there was really no way of escaping. And they were left in absolute, abject poverty, while the lords reaped benefits off of their labors. And the Tsars, of course, had ultimate control over everything in society and made themselves rich. Then, of course, communism took over in 1917 after the revolution. And the greatest lie of communism was that they were going to free the Russian people from the totalitarianism of the Tsars. But actually what they did, in fact, was replace one form of totalitarianism by another. And now the Communist Party, and specifically the Secretary General of the Communist Party, became the dictator. And became the sole authority in Russia and enforced his authority by the use of terror. So when we talk to people about authority, and when we stand before an audience as an authority, you're perceived in a certain way because of their culture and because of their history. The same is true because of the influence of the Russian Orthodox Church. The Russian Orthodox Church, too, presented a certain kind of authority, a sort of absolute authority. Not so much totalitarian authority, because the Russian Orthodox Church usually did not have the power to terrorize people, but in other ways they could exercise control over society. In fact, Russians were obligated to the Russian Orthodox Church from birth through marriage to death. And all during the week, every day, there were certain traditions and ceremonies that they would observe as Russian Orthodox. So they were tied to the absolute authority of the Russian Orthodox Church. There was no questions to be asked, no objections to be raised. They simply were to obey what the priest would teach. And so the Russian Orthodox Church, too, presented a sort of absolute authority. What happens in society is that society reacts towards this kind of authority in different ways. Some people in society will just accept what people say because they stand in a place of authority. And that's one thing we have to be careful of when we're presenting the gospel of Jesus Christ, is when we're communicating the gospel of Jesus Christ, we have to overcome a certain reaction, a cultural reaction to our presence in society. When we're standing in front of an audience, and this is true in other cultures too, of course, whether it be in a third world country or some other country, when we stand in front of an audience of people and we're looked upon as an authority, they may accept what we're saying simply because we're the authority. But we don't want to do that, because that will counteract the message of the gospel of Jesus Christ. We may then leave, and as soon as we leave, we find out somebody else comes in and teaches them something else, and they go with that person, and we wonder why. Well, these people just aren't, doesn't seem like they're very well grounded. But the problem is, after we left, somebody else came in with the appearance of authority, and they listened to that authority and received what that authority said and followed what they said. So you see, we cannot play on this image of authority. What we want instead for people to do is reason about the scriptures and reason about the gospel of Jesus Christ and present the gospel in a reasonable way that will cause them to think about what they believe and think about what you're saying. Another interesting sidelight to this question of authority and totalitarian authority is their image of God too. People form certain images of God based on their culture and history. And God has been presented in different ways throughout Russian history. God is presented in a certain fatalistic way throughout history, in which man sort of doesn't have any decision to make, any free will of his own. He simply must have to give in to the whims and capriciousness of God. And people come to think of God that way because of the suffering and persecution they undergo sometimes. And secondly, when a certain people undergo such tremendous persecution like the Russians have undergone, they seem cynical of authority. And they look at authority many times as wanting to take advantage of people. And they form another concept of God in which they suspect the love of God. One question that some of you might have had in the audiences before when you're addressing an audience concerns the justice of God and the suffering of people. People raise the question, can God really be just and loving and still permit suffering? You don't usually hear that kind of question in our society because we don't see that much suffering around us. And we have sort of closed ourselves off to the suffering that does exist in society so often. But when people in a Russian audience ask you a question about the suffering of people, the suffering of innocent people, and the justice of God, that to them is a very serious question. And if you have any credibility whatsoever as a man of the book and a man of God, you're going to have to explain in a credible way why there can be suffering and at the same time God can be just. That's a very valid question. There was a man in the audience that I recall in particular, an elderly man that walked on a cane, that would sit up in the front row and listen very attentively to the lectures every evening. And he asked me on two different occasions, what about Stalin and people like Stalin? What will happen to people like Stalin? He wanted to know that. And I'm sure he was old enough to have seen innocent people, hundreds, maybe thousands of innocent people die under Stalin. To him, that was a valid question that would have to be answered before he would be able to accept the gospel. A question that arises because of the history that he has seen with his own eyes. And so when we go to Russia, our message is going to have to include that particular defense of the character of God. Two, another aspect that's clearly important in the preaching of the gospel in Russia is tradition. And religion as tradition. I'm sure if you've looked at pictures of a Russian Orthodox church or seen pictures of their rites and ceremonies, or if you've witnessed their rites and ceremonies, you know that it's a religion full of tradition. In fact, it is a religion that is tradition. You can best define the Russian Orthodox Church as tradition. It's not a church that has certain particular traditions, different traditions, for instance, than the Catholic Church. It is a religion, in fact, that is tradition, that is based on tradition, and that takes a lot of its self-estimation from tradition and how well they are keeping to tradition. That's the uniqueness to of the Russian Orthodox Church to the Russian. To them, their church is true because it is the one that keeps to tradition in the best way. The issue of fasting, for instance, is not just sort of an issue of whether fasting is right or wrong. Fasting is a way of life to Russian Orthodox people. Fasting can take up Russian Orthodox who observe fasting the way the Russian Orthodox Church teaches will fast almost half of the year, different kinds of fasts. So fasting is a part of their life, and tradition dictates how they fast. The worship of icons is another tradition that goes way back in the Russian Orthodox Church, back to the very beginnings of the Russian Orthodox Church and its unique identity as Orthodox. Icons, of course, are paintings of saints and other historical figures. And instead of the statues that you find in a Catholic church, you will find in the Russian Orthodox Church icons, paintings, hundreds sometimes of paintings, all over the walls, all over the ceilings, paintings that they hang on the walls, paintings that they carry with them as they're walking down the streets observing their religious rites and ceremonies. And these are very important to them. They are their unique tradition in the Russian Orthodox Church, and it's just as much a part of their culture as anything else. So when you speak about icons, you need to understand that you're talking about something very fundamental to their religion. It is their religion, the worship of icons. The baptism of infants is the same way. It's a tradition that represents in the minds of their people their identity and their connection to the society. Therefore, when you take away traditions, and here's the point, when you preach against ritualistic fasting, and when you preach against icons, since those objects form such a part of their life, you have to make sure and replace it with something. You can't just take away icons and can't take away fasting without replacing it with something vital, something that connects them directly to God. To us in the United States, the focus of our religion has come to be, for many people, Lord's Day worship. A couple of hours on Lord's Day. To many Christians, that's the focus of their worship. To Russians, the focus of their worship is seen every day of their life. And they have these symbols, religious symbols, such as icons, that remind them of their daily focus. They have certain prayers they pray every single day. And so you might say that there is a certain kind of dedication that is far more profound than sometimes the dedication you find here in the United States. And so if we take away their traditions, and rightly so, we're going to have to provide something else to take its place. We're going to have to provide them with a view of the Christian life that is vital, that includes daily reading of God's Word, meditation on His Word, that includes fasting in its correct manner, that includes singing, that includes sharing the gospel with other people, and that includes growing as a Christian in specific and vital ways to make their Christian life a daily life. That's what's important. So just preaching against icons will not satisfy the need that they have for a connection with God. we need to replace it with something else. That can be learned from culture and from the historical viewpoint that they find themselves in because of the beginnings of the Russian Orthodox Church. I might just mention something about icons that makes them so different and unique. Back around 700, the 8th century, the Greek Orthodox Church and the Catholic Church, the Roman Catholic Church, had already begun to separate. The Greek Orthodox Church had its capital or center in the city of Constantinople, which is now Turkey. And there was always a rivalry between Rome and Constantinople, a rivalry of government, of civil government in the Roman Empire, and a religious rivalry as to who was going to run the Roman Empire civilly and who was going to run Christianity religiously. And as the Roman government shifted to Constantinople, it became the center of civil government. But it also began to form its own center of religious government. And this rivalry between Rome and Constantinople continued until it surfaced in a discussion and in a conflict over images and icons. People in Constantinople began to teach that worshiping images was crude and barbaric and pagan, and that it was better to worship a painting, an image, painted on a wall or painted on a canvas or a piece of wood. And this became a conflict between Rome and Constantinople. And finally, there was an emperor, a Roman emperor by the name of Leo III, who wanted to completely split from the religious authority of Rome. And so he authorized his people to replace statues with images, or rather the statues with icons. And this became a great conflict between people until the soldiers would go right into the churches and break down the statues, crush them, to the utter horror and astonishment of people who had, older people especially, who had been worshiping those statues all of their life. But this was really a political gesture on behalf of Leo, wanting to separate himself from the authority of Roman Catholicism. Eventually then, from the Greek Orthodox Church founded in Constantinople, the Russian Orthodox Church arose and continued the same tradition of icons. So the worship of icons started hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years ago, and for so many years after the very initiation of the Russian Orthodox Church in Russia in the 10th century, icons formed the unique part of the Russian Orthodox Church. And when the Russian Orthodox Church began in Russia in the year 988, icons were already present in the worship. It was part of their worship, and they never knew anything different. So like we said, to replace the life or the vitality that icons give their religion, we will have to give them something else, something more vital, something that's truly able to give them life and meaning and connection to God. And so we will have to teach them about the beauty of the Christian life and the beauty of the Christian disciplines like prayer and meditation and fasting. Another aspect of the particular culture and religious situation in Russia has to do with morality. What we'd like to talk about is the lack of a moral system. You know, the approach we usually take in our culture to morality is to address specific moral issues with argumentation and scriptures, showing on concerning a specific moral issue, whether it be drinking or adultery or abortion or whatever the case may be, why certain issues or why certain forms of conduct are immoral. This method may be somewhat effective in our society, but at least in the past, we all started from the same sort of moral foundation and the moral authority. We had some moral foundation in common based on the Bible. But now in our society, when people are rejecting wholesale any sort of absolute standard for morality, it's very difficult to talk to people now about moral issues because we lack any common moral foundation. If you're talking to somebody about a moral issue, one specific moral issue, and whether it is wrong or right, you're going to have to be talking to that person based on the same basic principles or moral foundation. If not, you're going to pass each other in your discussion and you won't make any sense. That's why people who talk about abortion and scream and yell at each other about abortion, their arguments miss each other. And they continue to yell and scream because they're not starting from the same foundation, the moral foundation. One group of people may be starting from a biblical foundation of an absolute standard of morality. Another group of people may be saying that there is no absolute standard of morality. And when you have two people who disagree so fundamentally on moral foundation and principles, there's no way they can talk or reason about moral morality. Because of the historical and cultural background of the Russian people, this problem is particularly significant. Because they have not had what we would call a moral foundation. The Russian Orthodox Church, for instance, has confined its practice to rites and ceremonies, and at best teaching the Ten Commandments. But to a Russian Orthodox, religion is rites and ceremonies, and the proper observance of rites and ceremonies, the proper wording of prayers, and not how to make moral decisions. Communism, in the same way, could not provide any type of moral system for moral reasoning. Communism revolved around one central principle, and that is the right, that which is right, is whatever can further the power of the state. And that was their basic moral principle. And supposed principles such as the equality of human beings that Marxists wanted to teach and a classless society were never seriously pursued because communism developed as a huge bureaucracy of a privileged class of demagogues. Any other moral principle was subjugated to that one, that the state is right. And of course, communism lacked sufficient grounds for developing a moral system because it itself was an immoral system. Totalitarianism was immoral in its essence. Communism, too, glorified scientific materialism, which says that everything is the product of cause and effect. Your future is determined, and there's not much you can do about it. And if your future is determined by cause and effect, then you can't really make moral decisions. Morality is only relevant when you can make choices. And in communism, there were no choices to make. So, when we come to a society that lacks a moral system, we may be tempted at first to teach about specific moral issues, like drinking, for instance. But one thing we're going to have to do is explain to people why Christianity itself provides a superior moral system and how we can reason about morals from the Bible. So it's not just discussing with people about specific issues, it's rather teaching them to reason morally. In the same way, too, when we teach about moral issues, such as drinking or adultery or other evils in society, we're going to have to help people overcome those immoral acts. It's not just enough to stand up and teach people that these things are wrong. Sometimes the behavior require lots of assistance to overcome, such as drinking. And society provides no mechanism over there for overcoming those types of habits. And so we as Christians need to teach people how to overcome those habits biblically from God's Word. You can teach adultery is wrong, but we also have to teach what the Bible teaches about the family and about true Christian love and God's view for the home, God's plan for the home. So presenting the Christianity as the best moral system could be and has the power of being a major thrust of our appeal to Christianity there because of the superiority of Christian morals and of the beauty of the Christian life. We are accustomed to presenting the church many times in our preaching, presenting the church in contrast to other churches. But we ought to think about presenting the Christian life, too, in contrast to other forms of living. And the beauty of the Christian life in contrast to other forms of living. That, to me, is an incredible message. The message of the gospel of Jesus Christ. That Jesus Christ came to save us by teaching us the beautiful kind of life that God wants us to live. And redeeming us from sin of an evil, corrupt life. I'd like to mention something, too, about the restoration, the plea of restoration of New Testament Christianity. The restoration plea of New Testament Christianity to us is very important in our preaching here, especially in the United States and in other countries. Especially it's true here in the United States because there are such a large variety of religious organizations. Over 1,000 religious organizations that claim some connection to Jesus Christ and the Bible. And so we teach that religion ought to be, people ought to be united together upon New Testament Christianity. And that there should not be so many different denominations, but we should be one in Jesus Christ. And the only way for religion to be unified is for people to go back to the Bible, completely back to the Bible. The restoration plea is valid in our preaching in Russia, too. But it's valid in a different sort of way. The same kind of religious division is apparent, but not so apparent, in Russia. There is no hope, for instance, of the Russian Orthodox Church ever becoming one with New Testament Christianity. There's no real hope, really, of unity based on the New Testament with the Russian Orthodox Church, because the Russian Orthodox Church is an edifice of tradition that will never change. Tradition identifies it as what it is. But instead, when we go and preach restoration of New Testament Christianity, there's another motivation for teaching the restoration of New Testament Christianity, and that is for people to be one. You know, when you go to Russia, the most obvious distinction is between nationality and not between religion. There is sometimes a distinction between religion, but not so much a distinction between a Christian and a Baptist or a Christian and a Lutheran. The clearer distinction when you go to Russia is the distinction between a Russian and an American. Or the distinction between a Russian and a member of some other ethnic group in Russia. And one of the beauties about the restoration plea is that only by going back to New Testament Christianity can people come together and be one. Only then can we have unity in people. And only then can we bridge cultures and communicate with each other. When, as Christians, we have this method now, a way of communicating, something in common, Jesus Christ. And I'm sure you've experienced that with brothers and sisters in Christ in Russia and the kind of unity you feel with them. This is the very reason why we ought to go back to New Testament Christianity. We don't want them to be Americans. We don't want them to be one with us by becoming Americans. We don't want them to be one with us by becoming American Christians. We want them to become one with us by becoming New Testament Christians. New Testament Christians. And that's a very beautiful purpose and reason for preaching the New Testament, the restoration of New Testament Christianity. Also, what we preach in Russia, what we're going to have to do too, is present what we can call a responsible apologetic of Christianity. Russian people are very intelligent. The people you will encounter. encounter, the audiences are very, very intelligent. And they're able to reason. And they're able to ask questions and think about truth and what can confirm truth. And what we need to be able to do is provide a responsible answer or defense. The word apologetic means a defense. When we're talking about an apologetic, we're talking about a defense of the gospel of Jesus Christ. In 1 Peter, the 3rd chapter, verse 15, the Apostle Paul tells us to be ready to give an answer. And that word answer comes from a Greek word, the same Greek word that's translated apologetic. It's a defense, it's an answer about Christianity. This is particularly true because of the history and culture in Russia, because number one, the Russian Orthodox Church never provided to people an apologetic of Christianity. That is why they never explained why the claims of Christianity are true. The Russian Orthodox never bothered themselves with that. They never bothered explaining why we ought to believe that Jesus Christ is Son of God, or why we ought to believe that God exists, or why we ought to believe that God is loving and merciful, or why we ought to believe that the Bible really is inspired, or why we ought to believe that the Bible as we have it written today is actually what was written originally. The Russian Orthodox Church never provided any kind of explanation for that. People merely accepted in a sort of blind faith. Two, the Russian Orthodox clergy were never respected as very intellectual. In Russia, there is a really sort of demeaning attitude towards the clergy in the Russian Orthodox Church. They're not very, on the majority, the Russian Orthodox clergy are not very well educated at all. There are no real seminaries or religious schools that they go to, the majority of them go to. Their class or their office as a priest is mainly handed down from one generation to the next generation. And the class of priest is a very closed class. If you're a priest, then your son will probably be a priest, and he will marry the daughter of a priest. And the reason why this class of priests is so close is because most people despise priests. And they don't want their daughters, they don't want their children marrying priests. And so the children of priests pretty much intermarry, and the priesthood is something that's sort of handed down generation after generation. In Europe, the monasteries were usually centers of higher learning. And in Catholicism, the monasteries were places where monks went to learn theology and philosophy. That's not true in the Russian Orthodox Church. In the Russian Orthodox Church, the monasteries, the monks who lived in monasteries were landowners. And they had their own serfs. The monks in the monasteries were like lords over land. And their main object was to farm the land and to earn money from the farming of their land with the help of their serfs. And the monasteries mainly provided places where pilgrims could stop on journeys that they would make. And this was sort of a custom among many people in Russia, is to make pilgrimages. And they would travel from one monastery to another monastery. The monasteries merely served as places where they could spend the night, but they were not centers of learning. So for that reason, the Russian Orthodox Church never provided an apologetic or a defense of Christianity. It was never needed. This is true in other cultures and other systems of religion too, as a matter of fact. I was always interested in apologetics, always interested in giving a defense of Christianity, always interested in explaining why we can believe that God exists. When I started working in Hispanic work among Spanish-speaking people, among Catholics, I never used my background in apologetics because that was never an issue with people of a Catholic origin. If you talk to them about the proofs of the existence of God, they would just yawn. They weren't interested in that. That's something they accepted. But on the other hand, in Russia, people want to know, not especially the Orthodox in an audience, but the atheists and agnostics. And like we said, we've talked a lot so far about it, about the Russian Orthodox, but in the same audience you will find agnostics, people who don't exactly deny the existence of God, but just say they don't know anything about God and don't think that anything can be known about God. And atheists who actually deny the existence of God. And so really, our need to present a responsible apologetic of Christianity is because of the audience because the audience is sometimes made up, often made up of people who are agnostic or atheist, but who are people that are willing to listen and learn and reason. And that's why it's important to present a responsible apologetic. And what I mean by responsible here is an apologetic that is adequate. You may go to Russia and you may think, well, I'm going to have to talk something about the existence of God, and so maybe I have floating around up here certain little arguments that I've heard other people give sometimes. That's not going to be successful over there. Because people who come from a communist background, who have heard so much propaganda against God and against religion, are going to need more than just a couple of little arguments that you may have heard before on some, or read in some book someplace. You need to present a responsible apologetic. And for another reason, is that when we go over there and preach the gospel of Jesus Christ, we need people's respect. And we need to earn their respect by preaching a responsible apologetic. If you go over there and give frivolous reasons why God might exist and why Jesus might be his son, you're going to be looked upon just like they look at their Russian clergy. You're going to be viewed as on the same level as a Russian clergyman. We want them instead to see, to me this is very important, we want them to see that Christianity can be defended. The truth can be defended. Belief in God can be defended. And this apologetic will have to include, too, information about other religions. Because Russia comprises so much territory that so many people are of other religions are involved, too. In the south, especially, there are Muslims and there are Jews scattered all throughout the main land area of Russia. And not only are there many Jews and many Muslims, but there are also people who follow Eastern religions, such as Buddhism and Hinduism. There are intellectuals in Russian society who follow Buddhism and Hinduism, but are willing to listen. It's very interesting to me the appeal that Eastern religion has to people who are former communists. Because Eastern religion provides a very vague view of God. God is not, in Eastern religion, in Buddhism and Hinduism, especially Buddhism, God is not a being. God is more like a force, something that's present in everything. And so the very concept of God is very vague. There is also in Buddhism a certain sense of fatalism. You accept what is given to you by fate. And that same fatalism is seen in Russian society. Communists, for instance, have sort of given themselves up to accept whatever fate might bring them. And so Eastern religion has a certain appeal to people. So know something about Eastern religion and know how to defend Christianity against Eastern religion, and especially reincarnation, for instance. That's a question that has come up frequently in discussions, is reincarnation. Reincarnation is a common question because of the influence of Eastern religion. Lastly, what I'd like to mention is another one other aspect of our message in view of culture, and that is to talk about the dignity of man. To me, the dignity of man is a very important issue, not only in Russia, but here in the United States. Man has a very arrogant attitude about himself. When I look back on certain historical events that happened here in the United States, I've seen, I think, certain things, I think you can see certain things that have reminded man about his arrogance. You might remember when the space shuttle exploded and how that affected society. I think this explosion of the space shuttle affected society so much because the space shuttle represented sort of the ultimate in man's dreams and his technical abilities and his powers as a human being and what he could accomplish. And when it exploded, the view of man that many people had also exploded. The view that man is capable of doing anything and that if he makes any mistakes, he can fix them. And so that view of man sort of exploded. Other people in the United States still carry on with a very arrogant view of man, that man does not need God, that man is capable of doing anything, accomplishing anything on his own, of his own volition and power. In Russia, the dignity of man has suffered in different ways. Communism, of course, taught materialism, that taught the non-existence of God and the non-existence of the human soul. And when you take away man's soul, you take away his dignity, the source of possible dignity. And it's no wonder how many people could have been marched to their death, how many people could have been killed when man looks at another man simply as a body without a soul. People think of how horrible Stalin was, or rather how horrible Hitler was when he killed 6 million Jews in World War II. Stalin was directly responsible for the murder of over 20 million people. People were sent to work camps and sent to their death for nothing more than just a bit of hearsay from a neighbor who said that so-and-so said that so-and-so said something against the government, without any trial, without any witnesses, that person could be taken away overnight. The authorities would come and take them away. And they would never be heard of or seen of again. It's no wonder that countless multitudes died when communism was making collectives out of all the peasants' farms. You might have heard of collectivism. That was when communism decided that the best thing to do for the good of the country and for the so the country could produce was to make all the individual peasant farms collectives. And so all the people were herded onto collectives. They were forced to join collectives. And two things happened. Number one, people were killed. Whoever did not want to go, they were killed. Number two, the collectives quickly became a very disastrous form of farming, and there were many people that died because of famine and starvation from the collectives. But it's easy to see how easily the government could promote such a plan, such a disastrous plan, and not be worried about how many millions of people die, because man has no dignity when you rob him of his soul. Instead, there is corruption, and there is arrogance, and there is self-centeredness that has been part and parcel of communism. Two, another factor has damaged the dignity of man. But the message of Jesus Christ has a unique power of restoring the dignity of man. Because first of all, we teach that man does have a soul, and that's one thing we must teach there, is that man has a soul, and this gives man dignity. And that man's dignity is dependent on God. That man cannot do anything he wants to of his own free will or volition. He depends on God. And the man's dignity comes from honoring the Creator. There is no room there for arrogance or no room for self-centeredness. And along with man's dignity, you have to give him purpose. Because a man who has dignity, who has self-respect, is a person who has purpose. So for instance, if we're preaching the gospel in Russia, or we're preaching about true New Testament Christianity, and we preach about salvation, something else we have to give people is purpose. Purpose in their life, a daily purpose. I think they have to realize that some way they can touch society and make a difference in society around them. Because they have become so cynical about society and about the possible hope for prosperity. They don't see any hope. Many people don't. Christianity, though, can give them the power to touch people around them and make people around them different. And that's a tremendous way to give people purpose and meaning to life. The reason why so many people commit suicide, especially young people in Russia, commit suicide is because they are without hope. And if you can show people that as a Christian you can touch people's lives with love, with mercy,
and with the glorious gospel of Jesus Christ, then you can give them hope and self-respect and a purpose to life. We may have lost that here, and it may be difficult to give that to people, because there are many Christians who don't believe that they need to be evangelistic or that they need to touch other people's lives. They don't see themselves that way because of our culture. People in the United States, because of our culture, have become so isolated. So we may have isolated in their own lives, in their own family lives. And so it may be even difficult for us to go to Russia and teach people that the beauty, the meaning, and the purpose of a Christian life comes from touching other people's lives and giving other people dignity and self-respect. So our responsibility in preaching the gospel is to reach people with the gospel message, with the good news that Jesus Christ came and died for our sins. In order for people to hear our message, in order for people to see the beauty of that message, we have to understand something about the people we're talking to, about the audience we're addressing, and the needs and questions they have. And this means that you have to prepare yourself. You cannot go to Russia, of course, with the same set of gospel sermons that you might preach in a gospel meeting here in the United States. That's not to say that the gospel is different or that changes or anything, but there has to be other subject matter that you teach in order to be successful in teaching people the gospel of Jesus Christ. And that's what we've hoped to do tonight, is to present some ways that we need to prepare ourselves for preaching our message in Russia in view of their history and culture.